And welcome back. Our final hour, Robert Schock with us, author, of course, with Robert Bavall, Origins of the Sphinx. That's what we're talking about, and it's interactive, and you're next with us on Coast to Coast AM. Robert, anywhere near the Sphinx, is there anything that looks like it could have been hutches or places where these people lived before they either were wiped out or left or something happened to them?
Yes. The one thing that people have to realize is that the Giza Plateau in that area is a limestone karst region naturally, geologically. What am I saying? This is an area where you have natural caves. So the place is riddled with natural caves that would have been the best resource to go to survive when you had a major solar outburst. It would have been the best refuge to go to. So one thing I think is happening in that area is that this would have been a place that people could have gone to, at least small groups of people, to protect themselves in that horrendous time. And
you know,
for instance, we talked about the chamber and the paw of the Sphinx. Mm-hmm. They have originated that way. There are lots of underground structures that have barely been explored to this day under and around Giza, both artificial areas and natural caves. Many of the artificial areas, I think, started out as natural caves, and I think this ties right in with the story.
Remember the Star Wars franchise?
Yeah, sure.
What was amazing to me was there they were with incredible technology, the ability to fly to other planets, other mm-hmm. solar systems, yet they lived on planet Earth. Mm-hmm. They lived in structures that looked like they were made during the time of the Egyptians and the Sphinx.
Yeah,
they looked
right.
stone
that's,
huts.
That is very interesting. But, you know, there are certain things that there's really no substitute for, in my opinion. I'm maybe a little biased, having studied these issues.
And just a little.
Just a little. But when you're talking about protecting yourself from certain types of natural disasters, I'll use that term, natural phenomenon, for instance, major radiation from a solar flare or from a solar outburst, from a coronal mass ejection, from an EMP, and actually you talked about some of these issues, I believe, in the context of nuclear power, earlier on your show, right? In the previously, one of the best ways to protect yourself is through stone, to either be underground or build massive stone structures. No matter how sophisticated you are, in fact, even more important, when you're more sophisticated technologically and electronically, because all of these phenomena, what we base our civilization on, the electronics, the computers, et cetera, could be wiped out in the blink of an eye by a natural phenomenon like a solar outburst, even a relatively, from an astrophysical point of view, relatively small solar flare. So another area I'd like to point out where you see this really well developed is Cappadocia in Turkey, where they have huge underground cities from very, very ancient times. And I am absolutely convinced, based on the evidence, that some of those underground cities go back to this period of about 12,000 years ago. They were doing this for a reason.
Are you familiar, Robert, with the work of Michael Cremo?
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, he believes that mankind is much older than what some of the archaeologists and scientists have been saying.
And I think one important aspect, I don't agree with Michael Cremo and everything, but, you know, probably none of us agree with everyone on everything. But I do think that he makes a very good point that there is evidence for both mankind, and I think what's important is for evidence for sophistication.
Yes.
That you don't expect at a much earlier point in time.
That could be dramatic indeed. All right, let's go to the phones. We've got Robert Schock with us. Let's pick it up by going to Nick in Gainesville, Florida, east of the Rockies, to get us started. Hey, Nick, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
George, how you doing?
Good, Nick.
Please don't tell me to call come to your website. I tried desperately. I can't do that. But anyway, I don't have the knowledge, money, or I'm 72 years old with wanting to do something I've never learned how to do.
Well, we got to teach you that stuff, Nick. But that's okay. Go ahead,
money.
Fred.
I just need money. But anyway, Ed. Oh, I forget.
Robert is with us. Go ahead.
You know, but that's the guy I want to talk about, the guy that built that coral castle.
Ed Leed Skolnin.
Yeah.
Yes, I can't pronounce his last name. Your beautiful screener there tried to help me, but I don't remember that. Anyway, your guest, I'm wondering, this guy that built them, he didn't pay for power, and he had crystals, and he said that he had learned the mysteries of the pyramids.
Exactly. In fact, I think he is a very good example. I'm very pleased that you brought him up. He was building with large coral blocks, which are basically a type of limestone, if you would.
Mm-hmm.
He constructed his castle, as it's called, apparently, you know, pretty much single-handedly using a technology that he never revealed.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, we're not, I don't think many people are saying that he brought in ETs or whatnot to help him. He had discovered, apparently, a lost technology or discovered a technology that he was able to use to construct his castle single-handedly with huge blocks of coral limestone. So I think there's a very important lesson to us.
He had some kind of pulley system, Robert, but I don't think those pulleys could have held up those blocks.
Correct. That's what I think, too. And again, this may tie in with what you and I were talking about, George, where he was able to overcome gravity, essentially, to a certain extent, and then maybe he used the pulleys to actually position things exactly into place.
Next up, Mike in Cleveland. Hi, Mike. Go ahead. Michael, you with us? There he is. Go ahead, Mike.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, we sure can. Loud and clear.
Okay. Well, I appreciate you taking my call, and I love your show, and I'm interested in this because I'm no scientist by any means. I'm a former truck driver, drove millions of miles. But what I don't understand is, since gravity does work, how is it that it is impossible to make the blocks that they have and run them downhill? Because once things start going downhill, they're going to keep going. And I think that personally, I don't know. I'm not a geologist, but is it possible that they actually built it from the top down? And I'll wait for your answer.
Built it from the top down.
Hmm.
Now, that's interesting. But, of course, you would have to get the blocks to the top unless, and this has been proposed, but I'm not convinced by it. There was one person I was speaking with at one point, and this was a private conversation and private emails, where he suggested that, in fact, at one point, the Giza Plateau had been covered with rock up to the top of the Great Pyramid, and essentially they carved all the rock away and left the pyramid. But if you were doing that, then you would expect the pyramid to be a solid structure of rock, and it's not. It's built with blocks. So you'd have to figure out some way to get the blocks up and then lay them down. It has been suggested that they were using maybe some kind of system of water and pumping and some kind of canal system. But again, you know, I'm not convinced that we know how they did it.
No, not at all. Tom's got a tweet for us back in the L.A. studios for a question here, Robert. Go ahead, Tom. What do we have?
Robert, this is a tweet from TG. He says, when will they investigate the Giza Caves?
The Giza Caves.
Yeah, the Giza Caves, and in fact, they're a very interesting phenomenon. There are a lot of
these caves. As I was mentioning, there's some that have become fairly famous, what sometimes is known as the Cave of Birds, that type of thing. There are some caves that we found are underground structures that have never been investigated in the vicinity of the Sphinx. When is a good question? Right now, I was in Egypt back this summer. I had the opportunity to speak with very high officials, including the Minister of Antiquities, the Director of GEM, which stands for Grand Egyptian Museum. They're building a huge new museum. There have been regime changes. That's the American term that some people like to use in Egypt, of course, over the last several years. I am very hopeful that at this point, we may be able to get back to Egypt and do some serious investigation, pick up really with scientific investigations that I left off some years ago, and I'm hoping that those can be reinvigorated. It's hard to answer that question when, but I am hopeful. One thing, if it's okay, I'd like to point out that to try to help with this endeavor, I and some of my colleagues have founded a new nonprofit organization that we call Organization for the Research of Ancient Cultures, or ORACOOL for short. There is a link from my website. I believe there's a link right to the ORACOOL website from the Coast to Coast AM show page. And this is a way to try to raise awareness, but also to pursue this research. So I'm very hopeful that we will be able to make some progress.
Back to the wildcard line, Eric in Houston, Texas with us. Hi, Eric. Go ahead.
Hello, George and Robert.
Hey there.
All right. Hey, so I love the show. Love this guest tonight. I wanted to ask your guest about, I heard these great stories about as Egyptians trace their history back as far as they can, they have a story of the earliest stories they have is that thousands of years ago, a group of what they call the Seven Sages showed up on the coast in a sailboat and their quote was, the legend goes, it says, our island just sank. You know, our island, we're from some unknown island in the Mediterranean, maybe near there. And their island sank, and then they showed up in Egypt and taught, and basically sort of showed up with this far higher consciousness and higher development, and that we get so many, that we owe a great debt for all of our favorite things, including rigging and sailboats that created the modern world. Do you know anything about that?
This is one of the a version of one of the legends, and this ties in with the more general concept that I mentioned briefly before, and that is Zeptepi, the concept that the ancient Egyptians had that there was an earlier civilization, that it had come from possibly elsewhere, come to Egypt. Sometimes Osiris, people probably have heard of Osiris and Isis, the god and goddess, brother and sister, husband and wife, that Osiris was one of the people that brought civilization to Egypt. Again, the same type of concept, someone coming and bringing civilization. Now, this also ties in, and I'm going to be very quick and brief here, with the concept of Atlantis, which comes from Egypt. Plato recounts that it actually came from Egypt, and again, we have the concept of a big island, if you would, a continent with advanced civilization sinking due to natural catastrophes, I believe solar outbursts, and the survivors or the people escaping from it went to other parts of the world, including to Egypt, and found it ultimately what would reemerge as civilization thousands of years later, but that there were these bringers of civilization from advanced culture, advanced civilization that was destroyed.
Robert, do you think we will ever get the definitive how did they do it answer?
I'm always hopeful. But will we ever know everything? I'm not sure we will. That's a hard one.
And what will it take to get that answer? What kind of breakthrough?
Oh, I think we need to basically find records. I think that would be the easiest, quickest way to get the answer is we find maybe not complete records, but some further clues as to how they may have been doing things.
Well, like the Great Pyramids, there is no way they could have been built without some kind of archaeological drawing or sketch, right?
Yes, but two things you have to keep in mind. One, we already talked about it, how this earlier cycle of civilization was just absolutely devastated. If you think about how do we keep records primarily electronically or the old-fashioned way on paper,
mm-hmm.
both of which, you know, you can't expect to survive 12,000 years or so, especially if you have the natural catastrophes we're talking about, solar outbursts, wildfires, flooding, horrible things. So the records, one, may be lost. Two, the second aspect is that this was not necessarily public knowledge, and not necessarily public knowledge because it would have been very technical. How many people today, if we have a huge disaster, how many people today could actually reconstruct our technology?
Not many. But you would agree, though, they would have to have had some kind of drawings or sketches.
They would have. I have no doubt that they did. No doubt that there were incredible detailed down to, you know, each block maybe not.
Each chamber
for the Great Pyramid, et cetera. They didn't do this just off the top of their head without any records or drawings or blueprints or plans. It's too accurate. But I've been told, I don't know if this is the case, I've been told that a lot of the plans and blueprints and drawings and whatnot have been lost for the Apollo missions.
Well, you know? That's an interesting thing.
Or stolen, yeah. But my point is, between the catastrophes that occurred, the issue that not everyone would have had access to this, you know, and in some cases, and even today we see this, there are secrets. More or less, you don't release your information about your technologies. We formalize that legally with trade agreements, patents, copyrights, that type of thing.
I understand you're going on some trips.
Oh, yeah.
Bolivia.
Actually, I'll be in Peru, Bolivia, and Easter Island next month. I'll be spending most of next month traveling. I'm excited about that. I'll be in Malta in March. If people are interested, they should go to my website, robertshock.com.
They can go with you?
Yeah, actually, both of these trips, not all of my trips are open to the public, but both of these trips are open to the public. It's a little late, probably, to sign up for Peru, Bolivia, Easter Island, but if people are interested, you know, go and maybe we can fit you in. Malta is definitely open. Then there are other trips, and I'm not sure when, but of course I want to get back to you.
All right, we'll follow up with you on that.
Yeah.
Robert, we're going to come back and take final phone calls in a moment, right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to our final segment with Robert Schock, author, of course, the new book with Robert Bavall, Origins of the Sphinx, comes out in the spring. When exactly, Robert, will the book be out?
I'm told end of March, early April, but, you know, I know with publishers, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you can never be absolutely certain, so until I have a copy in my hands. But it can be pre-ordered now on Amazon, and I would encourage people to do that because they have a great deal where if the price goes down, they'll get the lowest price before it comes out. So go ahead and order it, but it should be out in a few months.
How much credence do you give to the Edgar Cayce story of the Hall of Records?
Well, this is difficult to say because I found, Tom DeBecky and I found seismically, of course, that chamber we've been talking about.
You did find it. Now, was it based on Cayce that
no,
got you to look for it?
No, not at all. That's what I was going to say. It was not based on Cayce. I had barely at the time heard of Edgar Cayce. I'm not a total ignoramus. but my mind was not focused on things like that. So yes, I'd heard of him vaguely, but I honestly had not followed Edgar Cayce. I did not know he had talked about a Hall of Records in Egypt, much less near the Sphinx. So we found it. We published it in Geoarchaeology, a very good scientific journal. We publicized it, all without having any Edgar Cayce connection. And then I was phoned, and I remember to this day sitting in my office at Boston University receiving the call from Edgar Cayce's son, because Edgar Cayce was long deceased.
Yeah, son. That's right. And his son was Edgar Cayce too, wasn't he?
That's right, yeah. And receiving that phone call saying that his father had predicted this. And that was news to me at that time, you know, after we had already published it. So it had no connection. I've sometimes been falsely accused of going out there to look for evidence to support Edgar Cayce. Not at all.
Not true. But even if you did, nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, nothing's wrong with that. I'm not saying this.
As a matter of fact, had
but
you...
I think it's actually more powerful that we found it in complete ignorance of his...
Well, you know what would have been interesting, too, though? Let's say we were doing an interview, and I said to you, unbeknownst to you, Robert Edgar Cayce, the late American prophet, has said that there are three locations for the Hall of Records: Bimini, somewhere in Central America, and at the base of the Sphinx. You're in Egypt, and you're going to investigate. Would you kind of look at the base of the Sphinx and see if you could find anything? And if you did that and found it, I bet you would have been flabbergasted.
Oh, absolutely. I would have been. I would have been. And I was actually flabbergasted when I was told about Edgar Cayce's predictions in hindsight.
Did they send you some backup data so they could convince you that he indeed didn't make that prediction?
Absolutely. Yeah. And since then, I've spoken at the ARE, Association for Research and Enlightenment.
Right.
In fact, I was just there a couple of months ago speaking. I mean, they're wonderful people, and they have all the archives, all the original records, and absolutely, he made these predictions. He said this. There's no doubt about it. You can go and you can look at the old weather dice. I'm a geologist, you know, the old tarnished papers from the 1930s. They did not fake this. He absolutely made these predictions, and so many of his predictions have stood the test of time.
When they told you about this, was Robert Schock in shock?
I like that. Yes, I would say so. I would say so, because it also did not help me with my academic colleagues at the time, and it still does not help me, because the last thing they need, as far as they're concerned, is someone going and... at least supporting someone like Edgar Cayce. You know,
that's great stuff. John in Hitchcock, Texas. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Good morning. Good morning, George, again.
Hi there.
Good morning, Robert.
Good morning.
This is worth staying up for.
Absolutely.
Like this is an awesome show. Listen, I have a quick question and a short comment. Robert, could you link the Egyptian pyramids to the Mayan pyramids in Central America, that ancient civilization there that was, you know, been there for thousands of years?
Yeah, absolutely. I believe that all of this is a relic of really what was probably, one could call it a global civilization, or at least civilizations around the globe that were connected years and years ago. It seems like years ago to me now, was I think it came out in 2003, but of course I wrote it earlier than that. I published a book called Voyages of the Pyramid Builders, where I talk about some of this, I don't want to say tentatively, very definitively at the time, but I think we now have even more evidence that there was communication around the world in very, very ancient times, that there was interchange of ideas, interchange of concepts, interchange of people even. And yes, there was communication. This was, just like today, essentially a global civilization in very remote times.
And John, you had some comments. Go ahead.
Yes. my comment is, I've been LDS for 38 years, and the book that I've read that really clears a lot of that up is the Book of Mormon. I've just amazes me that, you know, Joseph Smith translated the gold plates off of Egyptian and Chaldean. 600 years B.C. was those plates written. And, you know, it's just so awesome that Heavenly Father would allow a thing like this to happen, because it's changed my life for the best.
Well, it is dramatic indeed. John, thanks again. Tom's got a tweet back in the L.A. studio, our final one for the night. What do you got, Tom?
Robert, this is from Brandon. He says, what was the food like and what did they eat in ancient Egypt?
they had hummus and shish kebab and all those great things, right?
Actually, the honest truth is that they ate very well. It used to be the story that, you know, they were slaves and they weren't fed properly, et cetera. No, a lot of evidence is that they ate very well, probably a lot of fish, and they had meat. We know this in ancient Egypt, and the period I'm talking about, going back even earlier, back to the end of the last ice age, there is abundant evidence that they had incredibly nutritious food supplies. Both meat and also vegetables and nuts, things like that. So I think they were being fed very, very well. I think if we went back in time, if we could go back in time and sample their diet, we'd be very pleased. I believe they ate a better diet than we do.
The Mediterranean diet, Robert.
Yeah, Mediterranean diet, and especially in America. I don't want to go off on a tangent, but, you know, we don't eat so well in America.
Let's go to John in Middleton, Wisconsin. Hi, John. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
There have been skeletons with fair pigmented hair found recently in the soil under and around the Great Pyramid. Did these people build pyramids about the globe? And if so, did a meteorite or something hit one of these, sending blocks into the air, and these blocks then falling on the soil, because in northern Minnesota has recently been found a block with Egyptian-type hieroglyphs, and it's kind of interesting. Most importantly also, Thor Heyerdahl has a picture on one of the walls of the pyramids in South America showing blonde. I'm not pro-blonde, but they may have been light pigmented. Who built the Great Pyramid of Egypt and other pyramids
right
out the soil? But how do you answer that, sir?
Well, there's a lot of things going on here, and you've raised a lot of issues, which we can't get into everything now. But I think this ties in, number one, with what we were talking about a few minutes ago, where I am convinced that there were people traveling around. There was communications, connections around the world in extreme ancient times. Also, if you think about if we had a major solar outburst, if people were going underground at certain times, this may, in fact, influence the lighter color, if you would, skin, that type of thing. Even in recent times, for instance, in some cultures, people protect themselves from the sun, or they maybe have their young women go into caves to lighten their skin. This has been documented, so you can get things like that. When you have a major catastrophe on the surface of the Earth, you've got, for instance, with a solar outburst, even more than a comet, you can have things tumbling and falling because something that is associated with that, without going into all the technical reasons, are major earthquakes. So that could destroy large structures and have them fall and crumble, or large blocks falling off, as you mentioned. So there's a lot of things going on here, but I think it ties in with the bigger picture that we're piecing together of the catastrophes at that early time.
All right, final calls. Eric is in Big Lake, Alaska now. Eric, go for it.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Greetings to you, George, and greetings to you, Robert.
Thank you.
I do have a corollary to your, I know you stated, I've been listening to the whole program, the 12,000 years for the Sphinx.
Mm-hmm.
The proto-Aleuts up here, in Alaska, claim this same timeline, and I believe them.
Oh, I believe them too. Yes,
we have discovered, and it is not a recent discovery. It's in. I've seen it. I do a lot of teaching up here, and I was teaching down in the Aleutians too. Mm-hmm. That's where I first learned about this. In the Cogomil caves down in the Aleutian Islands, there are still Egyptian-style mummies.
Oh, I believe it, yeah.
And I'm sure you're familiar with Beringia.
Yes.
And the Bering Sea land bridge and how the sea level was lowered.
Yes.
And so I fully agree with your theory. Now, let me give you this. You might or might not know about this. Think theoretically with me just for a second. If you take all of the water off the earth, all of the seawater, then measure the lowest point to the highest point, guess where it is? And you know where it is? It's the Aleutian Trench.
Oh, yes, that's right.
And, yeah, of course, the Aleutian Trench is still there today.
Yeah.
But, of course, it's filled with water.
That's right.
Now, I don't know if they had structures or pyramids, but if they did, they're probably down in the Aleutian Trench somewhere.
Well, this is one of the fascinating things, and one thing that I'd like to do, and possibly through Oracle that I mentioned, the new nonprofit, because one of our members is one of our founding members and advisors is a specialist in underwater archaeology. There is so much underwater because of the rise in sea levels since the end of the last ice age that we need to look at, that we need to explore.
Okay, let's grab another call or two. Linda's in Windsor, Canada. Hi, Linda. Go ahead.
Hi. I just love this subject.
Oh, me
There's
too.
There's so much that has to be researched on it. Years ago, like you were talking about sages, well, in Egypt, they had, you know, the magis, and that's where, like, the eye imagination, like, they, you know, the stars, they knew about the stars, what was coming, what was going to be. But I want to get to this. I think that Edward Leedskalin, who did Coral Castle and used, you know, lifted coral, thousands of, tons, and lifted them all by himself with his mechanisms, and also Nikola Tesla, who around the same time, I believe they came from a certain group that's hidden, and they came out into the world. And I think Tesla gave us some of his knowledge to see what we do with it. And Edward, I think that when he built his little castle there, he put out signs for maybe people, like, you know, that could read it. But they knew the significance of, like, the number three, you know, the value of it and the universal speakings. And, I mean, they were just so full of mystery, and there's still so much to be researched. Like, what's your opinion on this?
30 seconds, Robert, go ahead.
Oh, I think I agree. There's so much to be researched, and this ties in with a lot of lost knowledge, or maybe knowledge that is still being held in a few select areas. But I think there's a lot of lost knowledge, and this is something that's very important to me, that we can learn a lot from the ancients. We can learn a lot of things that are applicable to today by studying these ancient cultures.
We sure can. Robert, thanks. Good luck on your trips.
Oh, thank you.
Always a pleasure talking to you. Robert Schock, what a great Egyptologist and investigator. And again, his new book coming out in the spring with Robert Bavall, Origins of the Sphinx. We've got great programs for you all week long. Don't forget, we'll be live on Sunday night, of course, on New Year's night as well. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Aladasor, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, and George Knapp. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.